Les colloques du Collège de France.
We are excited to now be with Diana Pinheiro, who is coming from the IMP in Vienna. And Diana just started her group even less than a year ago, or nearly a year ago?
Less than six months ago.
So thank you for coming, and we look forward to hearing your talk on morphogenesis and gradients and shaping, all of that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So thanks for the invitation to discuss our work here with you today. So mainly what I'll be telling you about is the work I've done during my postdoc and also the questions we're now interested in following up in my own lab at the IMP. And so it deals with shaping tissues via dynamic signaling gradients. And so, as the audience probably well knows, embryonic development is the process through which pattern and form emerges. This is a fundamentally multiscale and highly dynamic process. And I think this movie from early zebrafish embryogenesis really illustrates these key features of embryonic development. On this side, you can see all the cell nuclei labeled in gray, and the same nuclei here are color-coded according to the germ layer derivatives that they will give rise to. And what you can appreciate is that as the cells are dividing and migrating over very large distances, dramatically reshaping this embryo, they're also acquiring different colors, which means that they are committing to different fates. And really the question that we wanted to understand now is how the signaling pathways that elicit tissue patterning are coordinated with the mechanical forces and cell behaviors that are necessary to organize form during embryonic development. And so to tackle this process, I focused in the process of gastrulation, which was beautifully introduced by Jérôme just a few hours ago, which is truly the most important time in your developmental history. It's also the first instance in development where patterning is accompanied by large-scale morphogenesis, and it gives rise to the three germ layers. So the model system that I've used is the zebrafish embryo, and gastrulation starts at what we call 50% epiboly. That just means that the embryonic cells have covered now around half of this very big yolk cell. And at the interface between the embryo proper and this extraembryonic tissue here, which we call the marginal zone, there is a gradient of nodal signaling that is established that you can visualize here as a gradient of nuclear accumulation of SMAD2, which is the downstream effector of nodal. And this gradient of nodal signaling was proposed to function as a morphogen. So the idea is that depending on the position of cells in relationship to this nodal gradient, they will either commit to becoming ectoderm when nodal is very low, or they will become committed to mesoderm or endoderm when they receive increasing concentrations of this nodal signaling. And this globally divides the embryo into three regions. Things, of course, more complicated, but just to give you an overall idea of the organization of the embryo. Soon after, morphogenesis kicks in, so this is how the embryo starts, and over the course of the next 5 hours, you will see it completely reshapes into a structure that by the end of it already looks like a fish. It has a tail bud. It's fully patterned along the anterior, posterior, and the dorsal ventral axis. So morphogenesis really starts with the internalization of the mesenoderm cells here at the edge of the tissue. Once the cells have internalized, they start migrating to the anterior, giving rise to tissue extension. And eventually, all the germ layers will converge towards the dorsal, where you'll end up seeing the final embryo at the end. And so when I started my postdoc, the question that I was really interested in understanding is how are the signaling gradients, all these emerging cell fates, and morphogenetic outputs coordinated in space and time? And disclaimer, we don't have a full answer, obviously, but we have made some progress in understanding this question. So when I started, the first thing that we decided to do was I teamed up with a very talented PhD student in CP's lab, and we decided to take a deconstruction approach to understand zebrafish gastrulation. And so what we did was that we separated the zebrafish stem cells from the yolk cell, which is a main source of patterning signals during gastrulation. And we cultured these cells in serum-free media, just in a dish, and we asked, what are these structures able to form? What you can see here in this movie is that not only they were able to survive, but they're also able to specify the derivatives of the three germ layers. You can see here an anterior mesendodermal marker in green, which shows that they also have anterior-posterior patterning. And despite the dramatically altered geometry of this zebrafish eggplants, piscoids, gastroliths, whatever you prefer, they basically show robust morphogenesis and in particular axis extension by the end of gastrulation. Now, I won't take you through all the experiments that we did, but of course, one of the important aspects was to ask what kind of cell types can these cells generate, and not to our surprise, they were able to form the large majority of the germ layer derivatives that we can find in the in vivo counterparts, and of course, they are remarkably similar to other gastroloid systems derived from mouse or from human. We could further show that for their ability to pattern and to do morphogenesis, they need to reestablish nodal signaling, and this is achieved through maternally inherited signals that, in the absence of the yolk cell, kickstart the system, really. So while everything seems quite nice, they're able to pattern, they're able to do morphogenesis, one of the things that they are not really effective at doing is that they tend to form this exogastrulus, meaning that the mesoderm is not internal to the ectoderm, as it always is in the embryo, but it also tends to separate out, creating this kind of extending of the tissue. And so we're really interested in understanding why this is achieved, and this really generated two questions, because it showed us that patterning and morphogenesis can be, at least to some extent, decoupled processes. And of course, it raises the question of how nodal, which is really established as a morphogen, patterning the germ layers, actually regulates the mechanical forces that organize morphogenesis, but also how are patterning and morphogenesis so effectively coordinated in vivo that it almost seems trivial that they always have to go hand in hand. And so to tackle this question, what we realized that the thing that we really did not understand, neither qualitative nor quantitatively, is how the mesendoderm actually goes to the inside of the embryo. And so in order to understand that process better, the first thing I did was to track cells through the process of internalization back in the embryo. And here you can see a cross-section through the tissue. You have the nuclei labeled in magenta and the mesendoderm labeled in green. And I call your attention here to these arrowheads. The lighter colors indicate cells closer to the margin, and darker arrowheads indicate cells further away from the margin. And what you can appreciate as soon as the movie plays is that it's a highly sequential process, remarkably sequential, in fact. Cells that are initially positioned just at the edge of the tissue, right here, internalize earlier than cells positioned further away from the margin. Now, this tight coupling between the position of a cell and its timing of internalization, what it does is that it makes things really ordered at a tissue scale. So if you look at the relative position of cells at the start of gastrulation and an hour later, you retrieve the same color code that you had before, which indicates near-perfect preservation of positional information, here indicated by the dashed line. And of course, you can average across multiple embryos, and you can see that they're able to do this process in a very ordered manner. And we're quite interested about these dynamics. Why? Because it actually provides a really intuitive mechanism for how you can translate gradients and patterns from the inside of the embryo to the inside. But of course, raises an obvious question: how do you achieve such precise control of internalization timing at the cell scale, given that there's over 1,000 cells that internalize over a time scale of hours? The difference between neighboring cells is only of a few minutes. This is not an epithelial tissue, it's a mesenchyme, and cells are loosely attached. And there's nothing, no physical boundary preventing internalization anywhere else in the embryo. So how come it's restricted to the margin, and how come it's sequential? So just before I go ahead, I want to give you some introduction of what we kind of knew about this process before we started. And it was initially proposed to be a sorting process, so people took these cells in vitro and they saw differences in tissue surface tension between different progenitors. Cells could sort. However, when they quantified tissue surface tension in vivo, the differences were much smaller than previously thought, and they're no longer sufficient to drive active sorting. This made people look for an alternative mechanism. And what they could see is that the mesendoderm progenitors were highly polarized towards the inside of the embryo, more consistent with the migratory process. Now, since we knew that even a single cell was able to undergo internalization, and in light of what I told you before, that the process is ordered and restricted to the margin, we had two questions. How is the timing of single-cell internalization linked to position, and how do you synchronize these movements at the tissue scale? Now, one model that could potentially reconcile these two ideas could be that maybe cells have an intrinsic timer. Maybe they wait until they reach the margin to actually start internalizing. Now, to test that idea, what I did is to, again, take a kind of bottom-up approach. And so I designed a system of transplantations where I collected cells at different stages of gastrulation, always at the location where they're about to internalize, and transplanted these cells into a mutant that lacks both mesoderm and any gastrulation movements. And the slightly complicated setup, it's because we really want to be able to discriminate what is the autonomous migratory capacity of the cells that we transplant versus any collective effects that can emerge during normal gastrulation. Now, if this is a timer, what do you actually expect? Well, in fact, since I'm collecting cells always at the time point and position where they're about to internalize, we effectively expect that we're synchronizing all our cells such that all transplanted cells should internalize with similar dynamics. Now, when we did the experiment, these are the early cells. You can see they are able to translocate from the outside to the inside of the embryo. This was also what we predicted and what had been described before, actually. Now, the surprise to us really came when we took cells from what we call shield stage. It's just 30 minutes after the start of gastrulation. And what you can see now is that the cells are there. They express the right marker, have the right fate, but they can no longer internalize. And they stay interspersed with the ectoderm until the end of gastrulation. This was really a dramatic difference in behavior. Early cells internalized nearly in all cases, whereas these later cells could not. So this is really arguing against the idea of the timer model and rather suggests that there's a window of competence during which cells are capable of undergoing internalization. And this window is closed quite early, in fact, from mid to late shield stage. Now, this also, of course, raised the paradox, because while in the transplants, late cells cannot go in, in the embryo, all cells internalize. So how come they do that? And so we thought, well, a model that could reconcile these two observations is if perhaps the whole process is much more collective than we had previously realized. And so to test this idea, what we did was to combine in the same transplant the early cells that we reasoned might function as leader cells and pull the rest of the mesoderm towards the inside of the embryo. When we now combine them in the same transplant, you can see here these are the early cells and these guys here are the late cells. What you can see is that now together this cluster is able to undergo internalization, and it really does so in the organization that you would expect from leader-follower migration, with the early cells always at the front of the tissue and the later cells always at the back as if they're just being dragged passively towards the inside of the embryo. So this was interesting. It was consistent with the idea that contact between the early cells is sufficient to drive the internalization of the later mesoderm. And it also told us that we have been now able to recapitulate what is actually the minimal morphogenetic unit of this tissue, which is the leader cells along its followers. Of course, it also raised another question of what makes the difference between early and late cells. How come only early cells can internalize? And so I've told you about their ability to migrate. So there were basically two intuitive possibilities. Either the follower cells lack directionality, maybe they don't know they have to go inside, or maybe they have no motility, so they can't displace at all. And so to test between these two possibilities, what we did was to repeat the same type of transplants, but now labeling F-actin and actually analyzing the distribution of protrusions across these cells. And what we noted is that you can see here the quantification, is that at all stages, early and late, cells were still oriented towards the inside of the embryo. So they are all directional. However, what we did notice is that the number of protrusion formed for these cells is actually decaying in time. Now, I grant you it's not a very dramatic difference, right? You see that it's kind of a progressive difference. However, in terms of internalization outcomes, things are rather binary. Early cells kind of always make it, and late cells never do. But the difference, if you zoom here at the transition, is around twofold in protrusion number. So we wanted to know if that was actually sufficient to explain their change in behavior. And now I will cut a kind of very long story short. So the first thing that we wanted to know is, what regulates their protrusiveness and why is it going down? And so the first thing that we noted is that nodal signaling, this gradient that is known to pattern the embryo, is actually also going down in time. So nodal is not only dynamic in space, so there's forming a gradient, but it's also dynamic in time. And what we also noted is that the protrusiveness of cells followed exactly the same pattern. And so what we did, of course, was to increase nodal signaling in later cells. Now they become more motile and they can internalize. Or if we do the opposite and we block either nodal or motility in the early cells, they start to behave as leaders. So even though these differences are small, they are meaningful for the internalization potential of these cells. Now, what was slightly puzzling to us is that regardless of what we did, we always obtained rather binary outcomes. Either cells could always go in or they could not. But it was really rare that we will have part of the cluster going in and another part not going. So we really wanted to understand how can you transform such graded input at the molecular and cellular scale to something that is binary at the tissue scale. And that to us was reminiscent of a process that was first proposed theoretically and then explored in vitro monolayers, which is called motility-driven unjamming. And so there's a number of features that can drive the unjamming of cells. I'll focus here for the purposes of today on cell motility. And so the idea is that the tissue can change its material properties depending on the magnitude of the motility forces. If cells are highly motile, they can drive the rearrangements with their neighbors and behave in a more fluid-like manner. But if their motility levels are low, or just low enough, below a threshold, cells can no longer drive rearrangements, and they basically get stuck in their positions, and the tissue at the tissue scale behaves like a solid. So what we thought, our reasoning was, well, maybe the leader cells are just above the threshold, so they behave as fluids, they drive rearrangements, and they internalize on their own. But all about these later cells, even though their motility is not zero, it's just below the threshold. So the exact value doesn't really matter as long as they're below the threshold, meaning that they start to behave in a more solid-like manner. And the key difference between these two populations is here, this parameter, which is called the mean square displacement. So that's exactly what we measured next. Of course, early cells have a very high mean square displacement. They internalize, they have to. What was very interesting for us is we looked at the later cells here, and what we could see is that it's not just that they don't internalize, is that they cannot drive rearrangements over the time scale of hours. Here, the dashed line indicates one cell diameter, and you can see that they cannot move more than one cell diameter over hours, which is really consistent with this kind of jammed behavior here. So, okay, this kind of seems to fit this analogy. Can we now use it more quantitatively to predict leader and follower cell behavior and its associated dynamics and go one step further? And so for that, we teamed up with Edo Anenzo working at IST Austria, and he modeled this process as a bistable energy landscape. We start all our clusters on the outside, and in order to go to the inside, they have to have sufficiently high protrusive forces to overcome this energy barrier here. And it's really about the ratio between these two forces. So we also input a level of stochasticity, because as you can imagine, protrusions are something that varies in time, and we had no idea how to account for it except to include that in the model. When we run the model with this kind of simulations, we get this kind of phase diagram. At the two extremes, things are very clean and easy, right? When forces are very low, cells will never move. When forces are really high, they will always move no matter what. But things get quite interesting here around 1.5, which is a transition point. Things become very stochastic. Why? Because very small changes in your noise levels can actually make you sufficiently protrusive to go over the edge or to end up being temporarily at a lower level and getting stuck on the outside. So it's exactly this kind of behavior that we observe. When we now plot all the experiments and all the transplants from all the manipulations that we did, you can see here at this around 1.5 that you have cells that have on average the same type of protrusiveness, but sometimes they don't make it and sometimes they internalize completely. So really consistent with this type of picture of motility-driven unjamming. And of course, when we start averaging out these outcomes per condition, we can kind of populate our curve consistent with the idea that the gradient of nodal signaling regulates protrusiveness and internalization capacity by triggering a motility-driven unjamming transition. And as I said, we find this interesting because if we hadn't followed the events across all scales, we would have completely missed this, because things are graded at the molecular level, they're also graded at the cell level because motility is graded. However, at the tissue scale, things become binary. And so it really shows you that you have to look at all the scales to understand the complexity of these processes. But of course, everything I told you was transplants. So can we actually use what we learned here to go back to the embryo and make any sort of prediction on how the movements at tissue scale should look like? So again, in collaboration with Edouard, now he did a 2D particle-based model. You organize the cells in the same type of configuration as I've shown you in the embryo. We have three forces here, epiboli forces that just spread the cells downwards. We have internalization forces, and once the cells are in, they start migrating upwards, just to mimic what happens in the embryo. The key parameter is that we input the nodal gradient that we measure experimentally, and we assume a linear relationship between nodal levels and internalization forces, as we have observed in our transplantation experiments before. What does this do? It effectively makes only a very small population of LIDA cells, so only these very light green cells here have sufficiently high nodal to actually start displacing. All the other cells are passive. And our question was, is that enough? If we have a small fraction of LIDAs, can they pull in the rest of the tissue? Because it's a very pretty, it's a pretty big cargo. So when we run the simulations, what you can see is that this is indeed the case. A small set of LIDA cells can pull the rest of the mesoderm towards the inside of the embryo. And if you look side by side at the simulations and the data, you can see that they're matching quite well. And when we computed this order parameter for our simulations along the data side, you can see that they fit quite nicely. So this, I think, conceptually is quite interesting because it shows that the gradient of nodal signaling is not just encoding positional information in the tissue because it's inducing its patterning, but it's also encoding a pattern of leader and follower cells, which is necessary to initiate ordered tissue scale morphogenesis that is able to preserve that pattern in time because the relative position between the neighboring cells is preserved in time. So now this is wild type. Can we go further? Can we actually make other predictions other than the wild type movements? And so what we really wanted to do was to change the shape of the gradient. And for that, we turned to maternal zygotic mutants for lefty, which is the inhibitor of nodal signaling in the system. And what you can see here, and this was already described before, these embryos have an expanded gradient, and you have now multiple rows of cells that have very high nodal signaling. So there is a very clear prediction that you would make from such a gradient, is if the gradient is expanded, you should have much more LIDA cells than you normally do. When we go back to the simulations, we do not change any parameter except that we give the nodal gradient from the lefty mutants instead of the wild type. So there is no parameter that is tweaked. This immediately, of course, gives rise to a higher number of leaders because now there's much more cells with peak nodal signaling. And when you look at the movements, they become really disorganized. Now being at the front of the tissue makes it really hard to start migrating upwards because you're kind of trapped here at the back with all the other cells that start to internalize near simultaneously. Now, as I said, this is really a parameter-free prediction. Does it actually match what we observe in vivo? Remarkably, this is the case. When we looked at the lefty mutants, we have a large fraction of cells that internalize, and if you look at the color code of the arrows, you can see it's all mixed up. So cells that were at the front of the tissue now find it really hard to start migrating upwards, and their relative positions are completely lost. And this is not just qualitative, there's also a quantitative match between the two, and you can see that they're really away from this diagonal that indicates preservation of positional information. And this is just the wild type to compare. So it's not only that the gradient is important to trigger an unjamming transition, but the shape of the gradient is important because it sets the proportion between the leader cells and the followers. And you need to have few leaders for many followers to make things very ordered at the tissue scale. So basically, as a brief summary, what I've shown you so far is that this nodal signaling gradient that we know very well to be patterning this tissue is also encoding a motility gradient within the mesendoderm, and that cells with very high nodal signaling levels will be able to start moving and trigger tissue scale unjamming that is driving the internalization of a large fraction of the mesoderm over time. And so when we reach this stage, we kind of ask ourselves, is that it? So if you start out in an ordered manner, is that sufficient to preserve that order in time? And this question, unfortunately, didn't come to us automatically. It came to us from looking at the simulations over time. And you might have already noticed that. Initially, things look out really good. But what you also see in time is that you start to get some LIDA cells that are stuck at the back of the tissue. And why is that? Because once cells are starting to accumulate inside, and they are migrating in opposite directions to the tissue that is just going down, well, there's nothing that prevents these cells from interacting here as well. And so, essentially, you start to lose the order that you started out immediately because the LIDAs get trapped interacting with these cells over the new tissue boundary that wasn't there before. And we were kind of worried that this was also true in vivo, but in fact it's not. When we looked at later stages, the model gets really worse in time. You can see here in the R-squared. But what was really interesting to us is that this really did not happen in vivo. If anything, things are more ordered later, which is exactly what you expect if the tissue is in a more solid-like state, so there's less rearrangements going on. So clearly, the model explains the first part, but it does not explain what's happening at later stages. And in retrospect, it's also a little bit obvious because on one hand, if you have a collective process, you need a very strong adhesion between your cells, right? Your leaders have to pull the followers. However, you really need to make sure that you pull the right followers. You don't want to pull cells over the forming tissue boundary because that's just going to mess up everything. But you really want to pull cells just behind you, like in a train. You really want to pull the carriage behind you. So how do you achieve that? And so I will cut a long story short. We tried a number of computational solutions. We tried adhesion gradients, and we realized that they don't work very well. What works really well is to consider that nodal specifies an heterotypic code of adhesion. So what's the idea? The idea is that perhaps cells that have similar nodal levels bind strongly to one another, and cells that have differences in their nodal levels bind weakly to one another. Why is that good? Well, it's really good because within the tissue, the gradient is smooth, so the differences between you and your neighbor are always small, so you have maximal adhesion. But once you start to internalize, now you will encounter cells that have very high nodal signaling, those are used to be the leaders, along with cells that have very low nodal signaling levels on the other side. So there, at that boundary, you'll effectively have very low adhesion. So when you combine leaders and followers with this heterotypic code of adhesion, you get not only order at the start of the process, but also it remains ordered in time. And actually, it even makes it easier for the internalized cells to migrate past these cells here, which is actually something that we observe in vivo as well. And when we compute, again, the order parameter, now, at early stages, not much changes. Both models are equally good. But at later stages, it really makes a very big difference, and now you have a much better match between the two. So, of course, this is theoretical. Is there any evidence that there is heterotypic adhesion and that nodal plays any role in specifying this? So what we decided to do was to go back to transplantation assays. Why? Because those transplantation assays are very useful to assess the ability of the leaders to pull on the followers. What I did initially is that I took these stages here, 50% and shield, which are these two stages here, where nodal levels are still rather similar. But what we can also do is that we can increase the gap in nodal signaling across these co-transplanted cells. We can take very early cells that have very high nodal, and we can take just later followers that have very low nodal signaling. So what happens? Can the leaders discriminate between these two types of followers? When we did the experiment, initially the cells started out together, but what you can appreciate is that in time they split apart invariably in every single case, with the early cells internalizing on their own. They really don't care, they just drop the followers, and the followers staying outside until the end of gastrulation. And this was really a dramatic difference in behavior when we monitored what are those contacts that get lost when the clusters split. We saw a huge increase in the proportion of heterotypic contacts, which really suggests that there is a preferential loss of those contacts and that the leader cells can indeed discriminate amongst its followers. Now, this seems to support our model, but of course, the ultimate test, what you really want to be able to do is that you want to rebuild tissue-level adhesion. So the idea then is that if you actually rebuild the gradient in your transplant, that should do it, right? Because now you have the two extremes, the leader cells that are very high in nodal, the late followers that are very low in nodal signaling, and you can just provide the intermediate levels of nodal signaling by providing those intermediate cells. Of course, it's easier said than done. It's a triple transplant, but what you can see is that in that case, the entire cluster is now able to internalize, and you have a huge rescue in the ability of these clusters to remain together, really consistent with the idea that the right rebuilding the gradient is sufficient to rebuild adhesion across the tissue and make sure that all the mesendoderm cells will end up on the inside of the embryo. And now, what I hope I've convinced you today is that we found that this morphogen gradient that is essential to pattern the tissue, not just in the three germ layers as I've discussed, but it also plays a role in getting different flavors of the mesendoderm, so really complex tissue patterning. It also plays a critical mechanical role in organizing the morphogenesis of this tissue during gastrulation. And here, the gradient of nodal signaling, on one hand, sets up a gradient of cell motility, which triggers tissue scale unjamming, and this is necessary to initiate tissue scale internalization, but it also sets up an adhesion code that makes sure that the leader cells can pull on the right followers and preserve that order, not just at the start of the process, but throughout gastrulation. And we think this is interesting because heterotypic adhesion has been emerging now in a number of different systems as a really good way, actually, to enforce tissue segregation, much better than adhesion gradients. So we're kind of interested now in exploring and understanding that further because it doesn't seem to be a specific feature of zebrafish gastrulation. And of course, the idea here is that we have kind of a framework where a morphogen gradient couples tissue patterning to morphogenesis across scales. And now what we are interested kind of in following up to the future and what is really exciting for us is that on one hand we want to understand how nodal, but more broadly how a small set of morphogens in fact that play a role repeatedly, not just in development but also in organogenesis, can encode such diversity of mechanochemical responses from complex tissue patterning to distinct mechanical properties and cell behaviors that are necessary for morphogenesis. And of course we used to have perhaps all of us in our mind this kind of linear model where signaling makes fates that come endowed with some mechanical properties that organize morphogenesis. However, our preliminary data already supports that there is a much more direct link between nodal signaling and controlling mechanics, and it's not just nodal itself, but also the dynamics of signaling that is important, so we're quite very interested in exploring that further. And of course, this opens up a number of feedback loops between all of these different tiers of information. And what I think we really need to do now is to be able to precisely control and manipulate signaling and mechanics with very precise spatial-temporal manner using, for instance, optogenetics, but also track the events across all scales. So not just the signaling responses molecularly, but also the cell behaviors, identity, motility, adhesion, and tissue-scale consequences for patterning and morphogenesis, both in terms of precision and in terms of organizing these collective properties. And zebrafish is really a good model because it allows you to go across scales. And we're also very interested, of course, in exploring how these kind of concepts can apply to other systems because, again, the very few morphogens act in gastrulation not just in zebrafish, but also in humans, for instance, and we're interested in understanding how this actually translates into other systems, for instance, using 2D gastroloids, which despite their simplicity, are patterned by exactly the same signals as the zebrafish embryo. And so I want to just finish by thanking, of course, my postdoc mentor, C.P. Eisenberg, the collaborators, funding, and everyone that contributed to this work, and of course my team that is now joining me in this adventure. And I'm happy to take any questions.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.